Welcome back to the second hour. We're talking with Patrick Henningsen from 21stCenturyWire.com. We are breaking down the current geopolitical game and, of course, assessing the situation after the Boston bombings. There's a lot to talk about, and obviously some, many of the points that Patrick has brought up is issues that we could spend hours alone on, just, you know, deconstructing and trying to analyze. And I want for a moment, before we carry on, obviously, with the larger picture of the geopolitical issues that currently is ongoing, Patrick, why don't you take us back a little bit more to Boston, because there's a few points that we left out, and I think this is a good time to get back to it. As we know it, the structure as it exists right now, that will use any opportunity, whether it's a false flag or not, if it's, you know, real or not, to advance the agenda that they have going. And one of the things that always arise, of course, is when any of these things happen, is why this area? Why this particular event? And I was wondered how much of planning goes into the choice, if you will, of the events that happen. I mean, when it comes to big events like World Trade Center, you understand that this is, of course, a big symbolic target for any other reasons, and they really want this to have a huge impact across the world. But when it comes to the marathon at Boston, do you have any guesses or any suggestions or ideas of why this was picked at this point, or was this just accidentally happened to be a good timing for it because they needed another attack to launch into the media landscape and then into people's consciousness and awareness to bring the terror issue back into people's lives again? What do you think, Patrick?
Well, it's a good question, Henrik, and I thought about that a lot, especially in the last couple of days, because I was kind of writing an article about the irony of the surveillance state. But the thing about Boston is traditionally been a Democratic stronghold. In other words, it's more left-wing, much more left-wing. And Boston is the home of the kind of left-wing intelligentsia. But also, Boston is the birthplace of liberty in the United States. So as far as symbolic targets go, being able to conquer Boston and the people of Boston, who tend to be somewhat more skeptical traditionally and more politically active than a lot of other places in America, and more intellectual. There's more universities around Boston in the city, than more concentration of higher education than any other place in the United States, probably in the world, actually. Boston has more universities and colleges centered around that area than any other place in the world. So this would be a great sort of way to tame the American people with one final blow. In other words, the demonstration, the sort of exhibit of martial law, if you can pull that off in Boston, it's a really strong message you're sending to the rest of the United States. But it also serves to balkanize the country. And if you want to look at this particular regime, which is in power in the United States, this Obama administration, Democratic government, whatever you want to call it, what they've done since they've come into office, more than anything, is they've divided the country along racial lines and along ethnic lines and also along political lines and now along ideological lines. Sandy Hook, that event in Connecticut before Christmas, that's in Connecticut, just south of Massachusetts. Now you have this in Boston. So you'd have a very strong vocal opposition to gun ownership in America coming out of New England right now as a result. And already the opinion pollsters and the focus groups have sprung into action, and these things are calculated in advance that this will have a big impact in New England. And already we saw the chief advisor to Benjamin Netanyahu giving a speech only a few days ago saying how the Boston bombings is a really good thing for Israel because it means that the American people will be able to sympathize more and feel the pain that the Israelis have been going through as a result of terror. That terror knows no nationalities. Terror knows no boundaries, and it doesn't discriminate. Terror is terror. Okay, and this is coming from Israel, one of the biggest sort of state-sponsored terror organizations in the world. just behind the United States. So yeah. It's ironic that they would use Boston to catapult their kind of political agenda forward. And also, so these things are calculated. Make no mistake about it. I don't think I'm not going to be naive to say that they're not. The Israeli lobby is really on shaky ground in America.
Really?
Because people are questioning what Israel are doing for the first time. Even some parts of the mainstream media, they're not going basically and marching in lockstep with the talking points that they have in the sort of 80s, 90s, and after 9/11. So it would take a terrorist event to just knock people right back into place. So back into their lockstep with that sort of rhetoric coming out of, Israel, IPAC, and some of these things. And they're incredibly influential over U.S. politics. They write a check out. They write a check out for everybody who runs for Congress or Senate, and to basically secure the allegiance of any candidate, whether they win or lose, for the Israeli lobby, and also grave consequences for anybody that dares to criticize Israel for anything that it does. And of course, so I don't have to go into detail about that. It's pretty obvious. But as far as, yes, the choice of Boston, very interesting choice of theater for this particular staged event. And I'm saying this with certainty that I know it's a staged event. I'm going by historical fact, and also I'm going by the evidence of what I've seen on the day, and of course the FBI's involvement in these particular suspects, putting them up as the culprits. It's an interesting place. It's much easier to control a population in an urban area, a concentrated urban area, because already people are restrained if they're living in a super city or a big city.
That's right.
Boston's a massive city, 8.5 million, okay? Same size as London, the greater Boston.
And the whole city is in lockdown still, I believe. I mean, it was basically 3 days ago. There was images coming out from, Daily Mail and Big Picture on Boston.com, I think. But as far as I've seen, it's still kind of lockdown. Very few people are out on the streets, I think.
Yes, because one of the other reasons is they've announced that there's more members of this terrorist cell. So that talking point was slipped out over the weekend. So that would basically give the law enforcement and all the different agencies further green light to continue this kind of martial law situation whereby people feel that they're not safe unless there's a massive police and military presence on the street.
Yeah.
It's gobsmacking from an American point of view to see that people would fall over backwards for this so easily. But I have a feeling, Henrik, that there's a lot more dissenters in Boston about this situation, mm-hmm. and they've been absolutely erased from the media. So I'm trying really hard to get in touch with people in Boston, see if they want to come on air to the radio show that I do in the States, and also to maybe get some testimony that I can publish in some articles to show if there's anyone brave enough. It's not easy, because imagine a New Yorker who was skeptical about 9/11 to come out publicly and talk about it as a person, a man on the street. But I'll tell you what, the man on the street is where it's at. That's where the real power is.
Yeah.
In journalism. I learned that in Cyprus. We had opportunities to interview finance ministers, the heads of banks, and the BBC were doing this and getting this sort of the great sort of bureaucratic talk about processes and minutia of policy and this and that. We went to the coffee houses and talked to the old men playing dominoes. They told us everything that was going on in Cyprus. Names, who did what, when they did this, who's done that, who's the crooks.
Yeah.
We found out straight away. So it's getting the man on the street to talk, and that's what people don't realize. It's a powerful thing that everyone's voice has value. Everyone's voice has potential to contribute to positive change in terms of writing the script, writing the story, writing history. And people need to realize that and not be afraid to speak up, not being afraid to voice their opinion against the overwhelming consensus that might be in line with the official story or be complicit with the state in terms of this martial law situation. In Boston is a good example. But and their voice will be 10 times more powerful than somebody from Seattle who's raising their anger about the situation.
Yeah.
No, someone from within the community. And we'll find somebody in the next few days.
By the way, if we do have any listeners from Boston who are listening in and want to get a hold of you, is it best to do that through your website, or do you want to get out an email or something like that?
Yeah, they can contact us through 21st Century Wire. They can also find me on Facebook. I get a lot of people contacting me on Facebook. I've got a Facebook group, 21st Century Wire, on Facebook, which is linked to my page, Patrick Henningsen. And that's a great conduit for getting in touch. And Twitter as well. You can send us 21Wire is our Twitter account, 21Wire. And you can send us a direct message on Twitter and we'll get back in touch with you. There is a contact email on the website as well.
Very good. Now, I want to ask you more about what's going on in Europe, your take on Cyprus or kind of the larger context of that. And then talk a little bit more about what's going on in the UK. But again, let me return a little bit to Boston here and just talk about the choice of the weapon of mass destruction this time, the pressure cooker, and how much you believe that this actually is the case. And is this all a big ruse, or are they just putting this on, or is there something to this story about the pressure cooker? How much do you know so far? I think this is pretty recent news as far as I know.
Yes, the Department of Justice, the Attorney General Eric Holder, who I might add was involved in the Oklahoma City bombing cover-up during his particular role in that, is documented in 1995. So this is a guy who's basically presided over a number of major scandals and cover-ups. So he's the right man for the job if you're going to pick an Attorney General. Bush picked people like John Yoo and this other Vietnamese-American lawyer who basically rewrote everything that was illegal in America and made it legal with the Patriot Act and everything else. So it's very important that you pick an attorney general if you have a corrupt administration that is equally as corrupt. So Holder got around to finally reading the Miranda rights to this 19-year-old Tsarnaev brother who is, by all accounts, does not fit the profile at all of a terrorist. But nonetheless, he's been charged with using a weapon of mass destruction. Now, if a pressure cooker is now classified as a WMD, then, like I said on our website last night, millions of Americans are in danger of being caught in possession of one because a lot of people have them in their kitchens. It's absolutely ridiculous to call that kind of a device a homemade pressure cooker bomb, a weapon of mass destruction. Okay,
well, anything could be a weapon today, Patrick. It doesn't matter what you use. I mean, we put up an article on Red Ice recently about how a flour could be used as an explosive. You know,
yeah, chapati flour. That was one of the bombers in London. The chapati bombers. This is the sort of thing you can get in an Indian restaurant. It's like naan bread. You know, the chapati bombers. Anything can be used as a bomb. You know, so it's ridiculous. They're rewriting the language so that basically that charge carries a death penalty. And what they've done is very interesting. And this is a typical, this is how you almost know that the administration has been cornered. They know they're desperate because they know people know, a lot of people know it's a false flag staged event. They've trumped up the charges to such a high degree, okay, that this suspect will be forced to plead guilty to avoid the death penalty, okay? That's why it's a WMD. The last thing the authorities want is for a real trial to take place where real evidence is presented and the public find out, dare they find out something about this event, something about this operation, where someone was lying and someone's covering something up. That's the last thing they want. So therefore, that's why the DOJ, Department of Justice, taken this tact and trumped up the charges to an unbelievable level. So it's going to be, he'll be forced to plead not guilty if he can speak, but he's allowed to write now. But somehow his throat got damaged during the apprehension process. Nobody knows quite how that happened, but obviously some people might say they didn't want him to talk. The last thing these guys want is this kid to come on and talk in front of the American people. The American people will then realize that this is a big scam. So they've almost guaranteed that he won't be able to do that. So they can, the other brother's dead, so they can write off, you know, write out any biography. They could create any sort of narrative they want because he's not around to defend himself. So they'll make a whole backstory. They're writing the backstory as we speak, getting people who will help them write the backstory. So it's quite obvious what's going on with these two brothers. They've definitely been set up. Someone else let the bombs off. Those people were there on site. Those people could be seen in photographs.
Let me ask you this, Patrick, though. If it's true that we do have a lot of people out there who are on the payroll of the FBI, let's say, or they're working in some way together with the authorities, to a certain degree, then unwittingly, they might not understand or realize that they're going to be used for a bigger purpose, and some of them who are doing this might never be used for a bigger purpose. But is that completely not being part of the picture in any way? Is there no personal responsibility in being involved? I mean, certainly I'm not talking about that they should be punished in this way that they have, but I'm just saying if they're willingly taking money from the FBI, let's say, or that they're part of these drills or plans or what have you, then they're dragged into the situation with the partly being responsible for what has happened to them, correct?
Yes, yeah, they're definitely part of the they're part of the operation. People do have responsibility to say yes or no when they come calling, and they come calling for you to do your duty. You know, it'll normally be sold as you're going to be doing this for your country, or you're doing this for your community, or you're doing this for Muslims, or whatever. Yeah. That's how they'll sell it to them, and it's up to the people at that point. I remember when I was in London years ago. This is right around the Iraq War. I met a Palestinian refugee who managed to come to the UK, who was a brilliant student, by the way, doing very well in his studies, was set to go to the London School of Economics. And, of course, he was being recruited by the Army Intelligence. He was 19 years old, spoke perfect English, very well manicured, very nice young boy. He was being recruited to come in and because of his skills in language and also his ability possibly to go under into areas and communities. And there was a huge uproar in his family because his parents were in Palestine, so he didn't have any real legal guardians around. He just had cousins and uncles. And I'm pretty sure that they had to talk him out of it or buy him out of that job. He didn't know what to do, and he was, and also it's an easy prey. If you're a Muslim in a Western society, already you're a minority, you feel alienated, okay? A lot of them feel confused. They don't know.
A lot of these people as well, Patrick, they're kids. I mean, even the alleged, underwear bomber, and now these guys, and they're all like, teenagers basically.
Yeah, they're kids, and they're not really rational adults yet in some cases. I mean, 26 years old these days in the 21st century is still very young, okay? 50 years ago, that was a full-grown man. He would have been married with kids already. But now it's your adolescence extends into your 30s now.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, mentally. So, so they do pray. It's an easy target, basically, so they can go to these people and really ask them, and they feel compelled to serve the agency or to serve this particular thing or whatever. And also there's the attraction of money. The economy's not very good right now, so this any source of cash you can get without having to really do any work for it is fantastic. It's almost like a windfall of money, and it can pay your bills. You can send money back home to your aunt. You can help your so-and-so build a house back in the old country with some of the cash, buy yourself a nice car, go out in the town a bit, have a better girlfriend. There are benefits to having money, especially if you don't have to sit 9 to 5 earning it, okay?
Yeah, yeah, I know. Let's zoom out a little bit more here. Ultimately, if we exclude the money that's being made from the whole black market industry of drugs, weapons, slavery and pedophilia rings and all the garbage and perversity in the world, of course, if we for a moment exclude that, the other portion of all of this money that's supporting this whole system is coming from quote-unquote regular people who are just paying their taxes, correct?
Yep, regular people who are paying their taxes are supporting the sort of above-board industry. But the actual industry that keeps the wheels of corruption greased is the black market. And the reason is because it's untraceable. The black market can be used to bribe. It can be used to fund black operations. It can be used to do things that can't be done above board. But more and more, we're moving into a society where what used to be illegal is now legal, and what used to be immoral has become acceptable. But still, the black market is where the power is. If you look at the entire economy in terms of, you know, financial transactions, and of course, the biggest cash cow at the moment is sort of phony derivatives in the financial system, and all that money is basically being made by 0.001% of the population in the financial community and financial services. But you look at all the companies, all the trade, the military industrial complex, the food industry, the oil industry, all these things basically comprise the majority of the economic global pyramid. But at the top of that pyramid, in probably valued around, you know, $500 billion, is the black market, or more than $500 billion is the black market. And that's all those things you mentioned, which are drugs, narcotics, pedophilia, white slavery, brown slavery, whatever. Yep. And some of these other more seedy aspects, prostitution and so forth. All these sort of rackets and the illegal black market arms industry, these are the things that keep the wheels of corruption. These are things that feed the corruption in all of our governments, and not just in the third world countries that people assume there's corruption, but we have corruption in Europe in a big way.
It's the biggest, you know, corruption, place of corruption that there is. What you see in some of the third world countries is a very minute on surface kind of level corruption, which is, you know, some kind of local little mob, basically mafia. And of course, these are ultimately also supported, that's been coming out now, by a lot of, British and American, politicians and companies and what have you. I mean, even in Sweden, they have been, a lot of weapons produced there ended up in the FARC guerrilla in Argentina, in Venezuela, for example, down in South Africa and India, and then, you know, it passes down to other hands through the daisy chain, kind of like what you said before. But ultimately, it's being supplied. This is how I see it, anyway. It's being supplied and ultimately supported by the people in the Western world who are naive and who believe too much in their government and in the system that is in place, and just think that corruption is something that just takes, you know, place in third world countries, basically. Very, very gullible, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, people can't even get their heads around the reality. And this reality should have been drilled into people's psyches during the mid-90s in Belgium with the Marc Dutroux affair. Marc Dutroux was basically a prolific a pedophile, but he also built sort of prison cells in basements of houses, not just one house, not just his house, but a number of properties around Belgium. And he was a middle manager, in other words, of a bigger pedophile ring, and they would charge access to these victims who were chained up to beds in these basements. Now, this scandal broke, and it nearly collapsed the Belgian government. People don't realize how close that state was, at least the government elite apparatus, was to complete collapse, because the police were found, the judiciary were found to be complicit in this ring, and people knew it. Yeah. They came out on the streets, because the bottom line, Henrik, is, and this is also being revealed in the United Kingdom, in Great Britain. There's a massive amount of pedophilia, and it's used on so many levels in the political classes in order to baptize, if you will, people who are going to be moving into positions of power in Europe and in America. It's used to baptize them, in other words, to keep them permanently blackmailed and also corrupted on such a deep level, not just a physical gender level, but also a spiritual level, to keep them so corrupted. And there's money that changes hands in this industry. And that, again, refeeds the feedback loop, comes right back into play, and it keeps the thing sustaining itself over generations to generations, and grooming generations of generations, and corrupting and defiling people. And these are people in positions of power. And one of the biggest political leverage devices in European government is politicians who can threaten other politicians to out them because they're gay and they're in the closet. And this is a big problem right throughout Europe. And so that's meant to basically, that's why, if you look at a situation like, look at 2003, the whole parliament, the House of Commons in the UK had a chance to basically stop the Iraq war. Because if they didn't go for it, America couldn't go in alone at the time. And America knew this. It would not have the backing of the international community. Britain had to stand shoulder to shoulder. And everyone knew it was the wrong thing to do. How did they manage to get the Tory whips and the Labour whips to line up all the votes in the right way? There's a lot of people that have a lot of things to hide. And that is how the political system in Europe is constructed.
And it's all across the spectrum as well. It's a good point you brought that up. It's not just to one party or one bloc or whatever. It's every single person that's in there when the time comes and they're being called on to you know, put their allegiance and support for the New World Order. They're right there with it. No problems.
Yeah, because they're, you know, they have something to hide. They have something to protect. And their careers as well, and their reputations, and the reputations of their family, their legacy. Look at Henry Kissinger, perfect example. Best friends of Margaret Thatcher. Now, they're preparing Kissinger's legacy right now, because he doesn't have much longer, or he's going to be around. He's getting old. So they're building him up, and when he dies, they'll have all these tributes and homilies to the career of Henry Kissinger, but there'll be parties in the street celebrating around the world when he passes. I'm sorry to say, just like when Margaret Thatcher passed away, the media went out of their way to have all these gushing tributes to Margaret Thatcher. And meanwhile, in the streets of London and around different places in the UK, people were having street parties and, you know, hanging banners saying the witch is dead. You know, that's what the people saw her as representing. Okay. Now, so her and Henry Kissinger, both best friends of Augusto Pinochet in Chile, Pol Pot in Cambodia. These are all their friends at the time. You know, these are some of the biggest mass murderers and killers, absolutely despicable people in power, supported by the leadership, obviously, in the United States and Britain mainly. So that is the reality of it on the street, you know.
Yeah.
The media will want to paint it as something else, that we have to have reverence and we have to have respect for these heads of state and secretaries of state. And even though they are the architects of death in many cases, particularly look at Henry Kissinger's career. It's just like his rap sheet is, you know, it'd take 1,000 years to deconstruct all the sort of things that he was involved in.
Indeed, yeah, it's a horrible turn of events. What do you suggest people to do to stop supporting these systems, and how people ultimately can? I mean, as far as I see it, Patrick, this is basically about separating oneself from this systemic, you know, filth basically that permeates the governmental systems, and ultimately you do have government in a position of, you know, endorsing the system that it currently is run. I mean, they ultimately, with the police force and the military and, you know, at the highest end, atom bombs, they're going to be there to ensure that their will and that their way is going to be the one that goes through, pretty much. And the way I see it, Patrick, is that people just have to the best of their ability, remove themselves from supporting the system as much as possible. At the same time, of course, as outing this and sharing the information about you know, who you can or shouldn't support is very important in all this. I think information is one of the big keys in all that. The more people knew about what really is going on, the better choices they can make if they want to support it or not. But how do you see it from your perspective, Patrick?
That's a great question. And that's the big one of debate. Everyone's trying to find a way to crack this problem in terms of where they see their own role in society. Now, there's different levels that you have to look at of where you're going to participate, okay? The first level is, let's say, political level, okay? We have to participate politically, but we don't have to participate within the party structure that's kind of laid out for us, which is normally two major parties or one party in any particular country. But we should be involved in the political discourse as individuals. So when I make my stance politically, I'm not speaking from a Democratic or Republican or Libertarian or anything stance of position or party. I'm speaking from me, Patrick Henningsen. This is my opinion as a sovereign citizen. This is what I believe, and this is what I feel is right and what I think is wrong. That's where my voice is coming from. And I represent my family, who are also have the same name. And my family represents the community and the types of people that we have affinity with who share the same values about right and wrong and about ethics and so forth. It could be your church group. You know, I'm not against having an alliance with a Christian group. If I think that I agree with the majority of what they're saying, I will, you know, I will support their actions if their political actions are in line with mine. But the number one thing, okay, is also, like you said, is the media side, the informational side. This is the new paradigm that's come about in the last decade. We have a chance to participate directly into the mix with the use of the alternative media, with the social media, and all these different other tools that we have. Now, some people say, yes, Facebook is a giant data mining exercise. It's got funding from the NSA. Google's the same. Google, Facebook are part of the police state. That might be true, but while it's still available for use, I'm going to use it to maximum effect and use it to push information out that I feel is important for people to know so that people can be aware and make their own decisions. Now, ultimately, the one thing that everyone can do beyond politically and beyond the media interactions and activities is economically. If you understand that this whole system is tied together through a system of monetization, an economic system that at the moment is a debt-based system, fractional reserve debt-based system, then you have some choices that you can make straight away. The first choice is, are you going to put your money in a bank account, or are you going to put it in a local credit union? So one of those institutions will speculate with your money and you could lose it and they could close the doors and like what happened in Cyprus,
yep,
and basically steal from people. But the other institution, the local credit union, cannot speculate with your money, doesn't play the markets, and runs an old style banking, high street bank business. So if first step, transfer your money to a local credit union, bank with them, use their systems and services. You'll have more say in what they do and how they what they do with your money than you will in a banking side. You take the power straight away out of the banker's hands, because they are, at the end of the day, Henry, they're running the show. The banking elite are running the show. They give the orders to the political classes. They might let political factions fight amongst themselves as to who's going to be in for the next 10 years so they can all line their pockets while they're in there. But at the end of the day, they're out. After 10 years, another group is in.
Yeah.
And they're friends who have contracts that they're going to give them for government contracts.
It's all theatrics to keep people emotionally ramped up and taking parts and sides in a system that ultimately, you know, what is at the center of the left wing and the right wing faction? That's what's the brain between these two wings? You know, that's what we have to ask ourselves. Look higher up the pyramid and realize that all of this that's going on is theatrics. That's how I see it. The geopolitical game, the political game, it's to keep people occupied from realizing what really is going on behind the scenes. And while it's to a certain extent very, very simple to take a step back, it's increasingly difficult for people to step out of that paradigm, because time and time again, Patrick, they're drawn in these emotional debates and you know, current issues that are somewhat it hits close to home, or they need to defend a position or what have you. So it's, I think we're being played on so many different levels, and ultimately it's like a marionette, like a puppet, you know, someone is pulling the strings, basically.
Yeah, and the only way, really, the only real power that is the state, let's just take the state for example, the only real power the state has over you is the power to extract tax revenue from you, okay? Now, and of course, you've outlined quite articulately what happens with your tax money. It's being used to fund all these various things that, around the world, that we don't support. Generally, people don't support, well, at least I don't. But, so tax is a big thing. So what can we do right now? If you don't pay your tax right now, you, in some countries, can be sent to jail and imprisoned. But what is the loophole? What is the loophole around tax at the moment? The best loophole that's available is to start your own business. Because with most tax systems, there's a number of things that you can write off as write-offs, expenses, your home, your rent, your electricity, your water. You can write that off against your earnings in most European and American tax structures. So that'll get you out of that system right there. Yeah, you might pay some tax, but it'll be a much smaller check than the one that would normally come out of your paycheck. Stay away. You have to find the loopholes to stay away from statutory obligations, and they try to nick you any which way they can to try to get this out of you, get that out of you. But more and more, unfortunately, Henrik, the system is being shut, is being closed down. The net's being tightened to make it more difficult for small to medium sized businesses to exist, especially in Western Europe. Okay,
yeah.
So I look at, I have to say, Henrik, I look at my great grandfathers. They emigrated from Denmark to the United States. Why? Why did they travel such a long way at that time?
Because they were living in a hellhole. That is why.
You got it. They're living in a hellhole. So I'm now sitting in, you know, in the Middle East. I come from America. It's a land of opportunity, and I lived 20 years in Europe and Britain. Certainly, there's opportunity there. Yes, there is. But you know what? I could pick up the phone and get a job overseas immediately, and I couldn't find one in my own country. So I am a migrant worker right now. So the tables are reversed. The opportunities are amazing for someone from Sweden or Britain or America to go to a country like a continent like Africa or South America and to bring their know-how, to bring their skills, to bring their work ethic, and go there and make something substantial. And we're reaching that point right now again. It's happening.
I hope you're right. I mean, if we look at Europe, it's there's too much regulation, there's too much bureaucracy, too much control, and ultimately government is there to limit your abilities to become just what you're talking about, independent and doing it on your own pretty much. I mean, Sweden is I've talked about this many times on the program, and I still hear from people who have some kind of perception that things are good in Sweden, that there's no corruption, and that it's an egalitarian system, and everything is fair, and it's something to look up to, this kind of social democratic, paradise or whatever. And it's just, it's so far from the truth. It's a hellhole of control and subjugation, and ultimately what has happened is that people's minds are controlled, and there's no one who is even capable at this stage of thinking outside of that box. It's a mental prison that it takes a long, many years to break yourself out from, and a lot of people are not capable of handling that. And I definitely understand, you know, why people took off from the European continent, 200-300 years ago, 100 years ago, to try to get some new opportunities, to be able to handle their own business, and just simply get out. So I mean, so from my perspective, it's horrible to see what has happened in America, and things have turned around there, and it is basically in some regards, it's even worse, of course, and in other regards, it's still a little bit more lighter. There's some more opportunities that you can, I think, have in America than as opposed to Europe. But ultimately, they are seeking to implement the same system around the world, a world government, which, you know, so many are talking about at this stage. And that's why that it's so horrible to me anyway, Patrick, because it means that there is no true diversity or differences between the different cultures, the different countries where you can, you know, have had different opportunities in different areas. But as you say, Patrick, you've been managed to do it by just getting out and getting, you know, opportunities overseas. And that I think that should be an example to people, and they should realize what actually is happening in their own country. So many people are looking to other countries all the time, looking abroad or somewhere else to see, oh, where it's worse, or you know, people are suffering there or here or what have you. But ultimately, all we can do is look at our own local area and point out the bullshit and try to improve it as the best as we can. That's how I see it anyway, Patrick.
Yeah, you can't. It's past the point where you can say you can run away from this kind of thing that's encroaching on our lives and on society. And I believe, and it's funny, you mentioned Sweden. It's held up always by academia and in the Western media as, oh, they've done this in Sweden, so we should try it here. It's kind of a template for this kind of hybrid social democracy.
Absolutely.
They're constantly toting it around as, oh, we should do this because Sweden has done it and they've been successful. Well, the reality is that it's not as cut and dried. If you actually go and live in Sweden, I'm sure it's a lot more complicated. It's a lot more complicated than the British or the American media might have you believe.
The Nordic model, Patrick, sorry to interrupt you. I want you to finish that. The Nordic model, I've talked about it before. I haven't talked about it enough. But the fact is that there are major think tanks behind why this is being promoted around the world, like Legatum is one of these think tanks, and you have people even from the CFR in these organizations, and they are continually pointing out that Sweden is being basically the one country to look up to. Denmark is high up there as well, including Norway, of course, and Finland, and they always rank very, very high on that place where it's the happiest to live in the world. But I urge anyone to go to these countries and work there, live there for 10, 15 years and see how you like it. Just get a feel for the general atmosphere where people are at in their mind and in their, you know, overall psyche and approach to government. It is such a police state. It's everything is under such incredible control. So people have to ask themselves, why is the system being promoted around the world? I mean, I could sit here for hours and just bash the system and try to break everything down piece by piece. And I'm certainly going to continue doing that in the future. But just for the short end of it, please, when you hear these things, think about it. There is a reason why these people from these major think tanks across the world are promoting these systems, because ultimately it means control. It means incredible government regulation and domination pretty much over your life. So please think about it. Please go ahead, Patrick.
Yeah, what they're doing is they want you to be, at the end of the day, this system, this kind of socialist utopian system, which is essentially a communist system, but it's communism married with fascism. So in order to make it too expensive for anybody or too regulated for anyone to have to start their own enterprise or their own business. In other words, they then become dependent on two people, either the state or a major corporation.
Yep.
So you have monopolies. Monopolies are allowed to maintain in place in this sort of communist fascist system. And small businesses and one-man shows, family businesses, are being pushed out and not being allowed to operate. So people are not being allowed to be self-sufficient. It's breaking up the families, forcing people to move to the cities to find work, break and put their parents in nursing homes when they reach a certain age.
Agenda 21 is very high on the list up in Sweden. I think they're further ahead there than in any other country, and it's actually exactly in lockstep with the plan of Agenda 21. Go ahead, Patrick.
Yes, Agenda 21 is a big one that people need to fight against. It's pernicious and evil in its shape, and it's determined to conquer at least Western Europe and the United States first before it makes its way to the rest of the world. But, you know, look at America and, you know, Sweden and Europe are the most over-medicated cultures in the world, in either medicated by pharmaceuticals or by alcohol.
Yeah.
Because you have no choice. You need to. There's nothing else going on. this whole industry is around drugs and alcohol right now in Europe and America that are so buoyant because people are just in droves going into them constantly. It's like a giant wheel, generation after generation, because people are being forced. There's nothing else going. So wait for your dole check, get your government check, go spend some of it on getting drunk.
Which is controlled. The alcohol monopoly is controlled by the government ultimately, so they're making money on your abuse, you know, in Sweden.
Absolutely.
I mean, come on.
Absolutely. The price of a pint of beer, if people knew what it costs to produce that and get it to you in that glass, and they knew how much of that was taxed and regulated, that you're drinking and you're paying huge amounts of money to your government by getting involved in that. And of course, they'll shut you down if you start brewing your own beer in your house and selling it to your friends and neighbors.
Oh yeah.
And forget about opening a bar in your living room to invite people over and play music, because that's illegal. You won't pass regulatory standards. So the whole system is gamed. So I think it's really important that people realize that you have two choices. You have to depend on yourself, or you have to depend on the state. And if you borrow money, or you sort of take income support, and you just basically check out the system and you give up, you become fully dependent on the state and the banks. You need loans for holidays. You know, you need to buy your car on loan. Stop borrowing money. This is step number one. I stopped borrowing money and credit cards and everything in 2007. So I'm in my sixth year of not borrowing or taking any loans. Okay.
Yeah.
Now it's changed. It changed my life drastically, and it became very difficult to do some things. And I had been forced to get a debit card in order to rent cars and things like that, because you couldn't rent cars when you're traveling and things like that without a card. Okay, but there are alternatives. There are ways around things that you can do, book online in advance, just to stay out of that system. Because as soon as you borrow any money, you're locked in. You're supporting the beast that is really ruling the world at the moment, and it's doing that by debt. So get out of the debt cycle. That's number one. Yeah. Number two, get out of that idea that you must be working for a company, that you cannot work for yourself. You can work for yourself. There's a lot of opportunities to do that, and you can carve a niche for yourself. You can, find ways around regulations and around the state who wants a monopoly over various markets. You can find cash economies. They still exist, and it's your choice. You can either keep trying to go and be truly independent and try to be sovereign, or you can just basically cave in and give up and get in the system. And for the people I know that have caved in and given up in the system, they're some of the most unhappy people I've ever met. And again, they're spending all of their disposable income getting drunk, trying to forget about the life that they could have had.
Yeah.
So, you can be happy without having to participate in these things. And there's a whole world out there, that is not expensive, that you can go grab by the horns if you want to get out there. And if you live in Sweden or Norway, man, there's a massive market for your what you are as a product of good education and a highly skilled workforce to go out to a developing world country, and they will welcome you with open arms to do anything from teaching to running businesses to doing marketing to teaching English. There's a whole world available out there, and there's opportunity out there, and you can further your own individual goals by doing that. So I do encourage people to look outwards and not to be afraid to make that step if they are ready to.
All right, very good, Patrick. Now we have we have 10 or so minutes left here to go, and in that time, I wanted to talk a little bit more about the press regulation in the UK that we briefly talked about in the break, basically. And something new is occurring in the UK with bloggers that actually might change even the whole environment in the EU at this point. And it goes back to the phone hacking scandals and everything that's been unfolding for years now. Tell us about this and detail a little bit what's going on in the UK.
Well, a few years ago, people might know the high profile scandal which occurred with the Sun newspaper and the News of the World and the Times and basically the Rupert Murdoch media empire and Sky as well. We're sending people out, and there were phone hacking, so they had reporters and investigators hiring PIs, tapping people's phones. Now, this came to be a big scandal, and of course, it was dragged in front of a government inquiry. People wanted to get to the bottom of it. Celebrities were hacked, Hugh Grant, you name it. Now, what this did was, this is very interesting, how this came about. How this came about was quite simple. Rupert Murdoch, his organizations will not hire people, or basically forced everybody to not be a member of the Journalist Union. Okay. Now, the Journalist Union isn't so much about paying dues, but you have to adhere to a certain code of practice in order to be a member. Otherwise, you lose your membership. So by getting rid of that, that was step one. Now, if someone wanted the job, they had to do whatever the boss told them to keep the job. So this opened the door to some corruption. But what is the biggest competitor to the mainstream media right now is the alternative media. This is where the majority of people are going to get their information and news online. This is killing advertising revenues. Sales are plummeting. A lot of these newspapers are bankrupt on paper. It's just a question of time before they have to fold. TV advertising, it's the industry is shrinking constantly, every day, every year. Okay, what is the easiest way is to claw back some of that market is by regulating the internet. And Rupert Murdoch was, I believe, complicit with some of the higher elites to engineer a false crisis over the phone hacking. I mean, this is aside from the fact, Henrik, that the government is allowed to tap and hack and listen in on all your calls.
Well, exactly.
Of course, that's not raised at all in this debate.
No.
So what they've done is they created the Leveson Inquiry, and they how Britain does any sort of crisis or scandal, like with the Iraq War, they put together an inquiry. An inquiry basically, his job is to do nothing, but to achieve some sort of goal at the end. And in the case of the Leveson Inquiry in the UK, the goal, they said, was to clean up the press. Well, the press didn't need any cleaning up, because at the end of the day, there's a court system that's there, that's available for people to be brought to court and charged and whatever, pay fines or do jail time if they've done something like tap people illegally. So what this is a runaround to basically push the legal rule of law aside. Let's do this with statutory government courts, which aren't really law courts. They're sort of secret courts where you don't have a jury, you don't have counsel. You just go in and they tell you what you've been charged. You basically have to comply. Otherwise, you face the consequences. That's what Leveson is essentially set up in the UK. And I always thought that the whole ruse was to regulate the internet. And of course, they took the opportunity to do that. In secret, they had a separate panel behind this big inquiry, which was towards the mainstream media. They've asked all the mainstream media to basically sign on to this independent press kind of organization that the government has set up. And also it has rules on whistleblowing. So this is two things, a war on whistleblowing. In other words, they don't want you to have confidential sources anymore. They're trying to shut that down in Britain. They want you to go to the police first if you have a tip or any evidence. Huh. This is aside from the fact in the pedophile scandals, the police were involved in some of these.
Exactly. Cover-ups. Yep.
So why would you go to? Would you feel confident and would you trust the police if they've been known to be covering up for pedophiles?
No.
So this is a way to. They're desperate to try to corral this beast that's been unleashed called the internet, and they will be able to do it. Unfortunately, I'm going to say this: they will be able to do it on a regional level. So the UK could very well pull this off if they're draconian enough and if they're ruthless enough. They can pull it off to the point where they're now forcing bloggers, independent bloggers who have an independent website, you have to sign on to a royal charter. This is something that's backed by the Queen. So in other words, you need a license to blog. Okay. If you don't sign up for this, you could be opened up to exemplary fines. So they can fine you out of existence. like 200,000 or something like that. You know,
it'll be the future will be James Bond, the license to blog.
Yeah, exactly. So basically, it's that's kind of what they're doing. The whole point of the Rupert Murdoch phone hacking thing was to give the government seize the opportunity to use it with, I believe, the blessing of Murdoch himself to eliminate their competition, which is the internet.
Well, see, this is a very interesting point of view. I think there's something going on here, bigger picture. I feel a similar thing has happened with the financial scandals and the crashes and everything that's been unfolding now for the last 3 or 4 years here. I don't know what to call it, sanctioned corruption, perhaps. They use people like Rupert Murdoch and his media empire in this case to show the detriment of what the business model that he's running. It's more private, of course, but they're using it in such a way so that the government potentially, finally, ultimately can get more control of the system. It's going to be centrally regulated. I mean, if you do have enough of these scandals blooming out in the media, eventually people will ask, you know, what are you going to do about this? The, you know, government, you have to step in and do something here. And they say, oh yeah, okay, well, we'll do it for you. You have to give us full control of everything. We have to be running the show. We'll take care of it from beginning to end. We will set all the rules and basically, in effect, creating a different kind of monopoly. And what people will be fooled into believing is that, oh, finally, we have these corrupt individuals are out of existence now. And now the government is going to regulate everything and it's going to be better. And, these are some of the things that we've seen in Sweden, for example, where we have government subsidized media, where you basically don't have any, private papers. The papers who are there and the TV channels beyond what UK has as well, which is the mandatory TV license fee, of course. We have that in Sweden as well. But beyond that, we're talking about basically magazines going to the government for handouts, pretty much. And of course, they would never report on anything fishy. They wouldn't bite the hand that feed them, to put it in a more, simple term. So it's a very dangerous situation that's arising right now. And I've felt the same about the financial market and the scandals that have been unfolding there as well. It's almost like they've allowed it to hit the ground, to run amok so bad that people ultimately will ask, what are you going to do to remedy this? You have to control it, have to regulate it, have to put so many blocks and barriers on it to control that this, ever happens again. And people believe that they might, be saved at the outcome of this. What do you make of that analysis, Patrick?
I think you're absolutely on the money, spot on the money. You've articulated that perfectly. That's exactly the bigger picture. I agree with you 100%. The whole theme here is that, let's take Rupert Murdoch, for example. The state apparatus can deal with him, basically, and he can afford to bribe and give brown envelopes to politicians. So they already have a relationship, okay? Now, he can also afford to promote wars through his virtual monopoly of most of the mainstream media. And he did that in Iraq. And what he got from America was basically the IRS looked the other way on probably over $1 billion in back taxes for the News Corporation. That was the trade-off, the deal they did under the table, was they looked the other way on certain things because he was supporting the war, and he got the people to... So it basically was a privatized propaganda arm. He functioned that way. Now, the crisis comes, like you said, so the state then goes to the monopoly empire and he says, well, we'll let you exist, we'll let you stay, and we'll help you get rid of some of that competition, but yes, we're going to take over, we're going to regulate this and regulate that. And what will happen, the way that they're wrecking the economy, they're gutting the middle class, they're creating a gap of wealth that's been unseen in human history, with the very, very elite rich and incredibly working poor, I call the middle class now. Just everyone's in debt, so how could they be middle class if they're not solvent? So what that's going to do is it forces it's going to make the situation so bad it will force the public to come demanding to the state saying, how are we going to fix this? And of course, the solution in the economic issue will be, we're going to level the playing field so that everybody has the same. Well, that's called communism.
Yeah.
And that's where we're going. On the geopolitical side, the plan by the same token, the plan will be to start a third world war that will be so bad that, and it will be done with the complicity and the ineptitude of the United Nations behind the scenes as one of the main culprits, okay? And this is the exact same pattern we saw after the Second World War, where they looked at the League of Nations and said how useless and ineffectual it was. Therefore, we need to replace it with the United Nations. And of course, John D. Rockefeller was there to supply the funding to start the United Nations. And that's the current useless international body that we currently have that will be replaced with, and what it will be is never again, we'll hear that term, never again, after a third world war, and people will be demanding a world government, and they'll be demanding a world currency, and demanding a world army, so that this never happens again.
Yeah.
And so it's an overarching Hegelian dialectic.
Yep.
With a problem reaction solution, and unfortunately, this has been the way that a lot of change has come about in our societies over the last century or two. And this is definitely happening, like you said, in the media realm. And this, you know, look at the Swedish model there with the media. I think the UK should be able to look at that. In fact, I'm going to be doing a talk on this subject in the coming months to a group of people on a conference. And I would definitely like your input on looking, I would look at Sweden as a kind of further down the road than the UK is in terms of that, you know, state-subsidized media. I think
definitely.
Very interesting, very interesting. Of course, we're not the proponents of the Swedish system and the Nordic system aren't pointing at the media template at the moment. Not many people are looking closely at that.
That's right.
But it's definitely interesting. So, yes, that's the Hegelian dialectic to make things get so bad that people will demand protection. They'll demand equality. They'll demand communism, I believe. And maybe this is how things came to fruition in Russia in the beginning of the 20th century. Maybe that's how the Bolsheviks were able to seize power initially. But at the end of the day, at the end of the day, it's still a fascist monopoly. Even when you get your communist or your equality, you're still going to be a fascist monopoly controlled by a very few, and privilege will be given only to those who are inner circle party members.
That's right.
Who are connected, or who are the industrialists who own, and the families who own and control those various industries. So it's a fraud. It's a fraud of a system, and it's being perpetrated again and again. It's just been repackaged. Now we've got a different version of it in the 21st century, and it's a slightly more PPP version, or private-public version, that's being generated here.
And but the end result is just the same.
It's just the same, and it will invade. It's about invading further into your life.
Yep.
And getting people to shut down, getting societies to shut down. You have open societies and you have closed societies. Open societies are exactly that. They are open. They have free speech, freedom of expression, all the sort of hallmarks of what it means to be free. A closed society is people are afraid to talk for fear of retribution from the state or whoever, and that's the society that's closed down. People are afraid to take risks. People are afraid to challenge the paradigm. People are afraid to achieve something individually because they're afraid of make someone else jealous, because everyone's supposed to have the same. That is what you have, you know, the mentality that has been pervaded in places like Cuba and, you know, of course, in Eastern Europe.
Sweden as well, just the same.
The kind of, you know, distrust. And also people informing on their neighbors or their rivals to the state in order to, you know, because of jealousy or score settling. These are all the things that happen in a closed society. And it's a very dangerous, dangerous world. And it's like a Kafka novel. This isn't something that's fictional. This is very real. Ask anybody who lived in East Germany before the Iron Curtain. It's a very different society than the Germany you have now, which is much more open, right now than it was, at least on that side of the country, than it was while it was under communist rule. It was hell on earth for anyone who had any idea of freedom of expression or, you know, wanting to achieve something themselves or to challenge themselves and to be ambitious or anything like this. These are all frowned upon in this kind of, you know, super socialist utopia.
Yeah. Well, this has been very interesting, Patrick. I think we should round things up for this time. I certainly hope we can continue our discussion at a later time, of course. There's much more to this whole story, much more to analyze and how the game is played and everything else. But for today, I want to thank you for your analysis and for your time. And why don't we end you giving up your websites again, if there's anything else you want to mention, if you have any. You mentioned films, of course, upcoming and stuff like that. But if there's any other, you know, way out there people can help you guys out and support you for carrying on your media endeavors.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Henrik. I can just say the best way to support us is just visit our site, 21stcenturywire.com. Check our articles, share them with your friends on social media, introduce people to our website. And I've got a lot of, you know, volunteers that help with content there and myself. And also to visit our YouTube channel, which is 21st Century Wire TV. And you see a lot of brilliant interviews that I've done with David Icke, Gilad Atzmon, Gerard Williams, who was on your show a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Who's an amazing, good friend as well. And some fantastic interviews on our YouTube channel. There'll be more to come, hopefully. And also we will be, you know, hopefully giving DVDs for sale on our website to allow people to get a hold of some of these amazing programs that we filmed in the UK last year and the new stuff that we'll do this year. And also visit the UK Column, which is that's a website and a newspaper that I'm a contributor to, who I believe is one of the best alternative media organizations right now, certainly the best in the United Kingdom, possibly the best that I've ever come across. They are absolutely determined to fight some of these things that we've talked about, and they're very much on the side of the people in terms of fighting this back the tide of this kind of super socialist, kind of super European state that we're in danger of facing, and also the foreign policy issues that we talked about as well. And so do support the UK Column. I have a lot of respect for them and believe that they're doing great work.
Indeed, Brian Garish over there is doing some great work. We should have been back, by the way. Anyway, thanks, Patrick. Good stuff. 21stcenturywire.com. That's the website. Go there. Check it out. I hope we can do this again soon.
Thanks, Henry.
Well, there you go, folks. Thank you for listening, and we hope you've learned something new aspects to think about or dig deeper into. I could not do this without Frederick, Lana, Elizabeth, or you, so a big thanks to everyone for making Red Eyes possible. We'll be back soon. Please tune in again. Radio 314 is next with John Rappaport. Have a great day, evening, or night.